Welcome to the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. This is Episode 6, and I'm the co-founder and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobian. With me tonight is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Heyo.
And also, our regular on the panel, rounding out the panel, is Lester Crowe and his strolling bones.
Hello.
So, we're at the 6th episode here. We've been out for a couple of months putting out content for the podcast, and tonight's not going to be any different. We're just going to have a regular podcast. System Spotlight is going to be about magic. We're going to be digging into the mechanics of spells and blessings. And then to kind of continue along with that theme, our main topic is about faith in the old world, specifically the gods of the empire. And then we'll round things up with answering your questions, but first we'll kick it off with some news. So, I think the biggest thing that I've seen in the last 2 weeks is that all three guides, the player's guide, the creature's guide, and the GM's guide, are all available for you to download, but pay money, of course, and download as PDFs on DriveThruRPG and RPG Now.
Are those the same ones that the original core set books were available on? I remember seeing them for purchase on the Fantasy Flight site, but are these kind of like the sanctioned vendors, or is anybody able to sell the PDFs?
Lester, I think you've clicked on that link, haven't you?
Yeah, as far as I know, if you try to purchase through Fantasy Flight's website on the PDFs, they send you directly to DriveThruRPG. It's essentially linked there, so it's my understanding that they've probably outsourced to them as far as their vendor for the PDFs is concerned.
Do you guys, I know there's a lot of, backlash is the right word, but the original series of PDFs that were available had a lot of compatibility issues and performance issues. I know there were layered PDFs, which has had loads and loads of objects on every page, so scrolling from page to page on the document was a chore and incredibly system-intensive for some people. And I know that one of my buddies who had it, as I was playing around with it, several pages wouldn't even render. They were just broken. I wonder if they, this is their second iteration of producing PDFs for their books. Do you think they, maybe learned their lesson and made them a little more user-friendly this time?
I'd hope so. I haven't gotten them myself. I mean, I've still got the hardbacks in front of me. You know, maybe if I had like an iPad or an Android tablet or something like that, that'd be something to, to reference.
Somebody brought that up on the forums the other day, what PDF reader specifically could best handle these beasts of a PDF that these books are, with the intent of using it, I think it was, on an iPad. And that's what kind of fueled a bit of that discussion on the performance issues that they have.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how the performance is. I mean, the initial response for all that I've seen from the forums is not really any complaints. But it's definitely a good question.
Well, I went ahead and purchased for the sake of having multiple copies of the original rulebook. I purchased the original core set rulebook, in PDF form, and I definitely experience a problem with the rendering, because like you said, it's layered. So it is extremely system intensive and takes a long time to load pages.
Yeah, there's no way you can like scroll 10 pages in a couple seconds. It takes about 10 to 15 seconds to get past each page.
Oh yeah, it's really system intensive. And I don't have access to any of these tablets, but it is my understanding that the engine is built to handle PDFs quite well. But it is my hope that, the PDFs for these new, for the new guides, I hope that they are laid out a little bit better. There's several different issues that I have with the PDF of the core set rulebook. But it is a nice, it's really nice to have to reference. Definitely.
I heard that these ones are supposed to be broken down by chapter and have a little better table of contents built into it. Maybe they actually leverage some of the technology that, the Adobe PDFs can use and, maybe make it easier to break it down by section. You can click straight to content areas or maybe even search by words.
Yeah, hopefully. Hey, Paul, do you know what
the interactive table of contents would be great. Well, that was my next question. Since the three new books are essentially pimped out as a chance to play the game without all the physical components, are they cheaper or are they the same price?
It's $25 for the player's guide, $20 for the creature's guide, and $15 for the GM's guide.
That's actually really cheap considering that the physical books are a componentless system anyway. So you could buy the PDFs and you can know worse for wear.
Yeah, you can get all three guides for $60 now.
So there's a question that somebody has later on in the podcast where they're asking, kind of reiterating the question or bringing back up the question on they're getting started. What stuff do they buy in what order? And maybe we should start, we should bring this up again when we get down there, that maybe these new PDFs are potentially a better entry point for some people who need a little less commitment or a cheaper way to get in.
Yeah, especially if the technology is cleaned up and like if you are utilizing something like a tablet or an iPad as your medium, then that is that's a really good way of going about it. Much cheaper for sure.
Except for, you know, spending the $500 to get the tablet. But
well, yeah, true. Fair enough, Paul.
We can assume that the tablet has some other uses outside of playing Warhammer.
So the other thing is that, as we mentioned in the show notes from last podcast, Omens of War is not only is it there's additional information that came out, but it's also listed as on the boat. So it's done printing, and it's actually being shipped to Fantasy Flight right now in Minnesota. So we're probably looking at maybe a month or two.
End of April, maybe? Beginning of May?
Yeah.
That's actually a pretty quick turnaround compared to Witch's Song.
Well, they might have things, you know, this is, I think Witch's Song, are you talking about the time that it took to go through or just the spacing between products?
The spacing between when the products hit the shelf.
Yeah, I think they really wanted to wait a while after they got the guides and the vaults out, mainly because it was such a big thing. You know, so they dumped a bunch of product onto the shelves all at once.
So you're thinking this development cycle, this kind of 2 month between product is something we could expect moving forward?
I think it's going to probably be 3 months between products. I bet you we get something every quarter.
That's still pretty reasonable.
Yeah. Well, there's quite a bit of stuff in all the products because they're still staying with the Chits version, right? Like all these new products are in boxes. And one thing I like about
none of that's changing.
Yeah, yep. I like how that is kind of harkening back to the old days of role-playing games, where that's like advanced second edition Dungeons & Dragons, that's how all the modules came, was in boxes. Just a good feeling to get those boxes, I think. I'm willing to wait 3 months if I can get as high-quality product as I've seen so far.
Well, considering all the bashing they've been getting over the last, well, months, I guess, I think that their production quality is increasing from iteration to iteration, and they're paying a little bit more attention, and I think they are listening to the community for giving them what they're asking for and playing in the style that the community wants to play, and not to mention fixing typos and whatnot.
True enough.
Yep. So we did get additional tidbits of information about what's going to be in Omens of War. Specifically, they kind of showed about the enhancement cards.
Pretty conveniently, that came out about 6 hours after we put our podcast up, right?
Yeah. Well, it was actually in between recording the podcast and me editing and posting it. So it was in between there.
That was nice of them.
Yeah. So it's an interesting mechanic because there's the idea, one of the things that we've been talking about in previous podcasts is that how easy it is to hit or how easy it is to be successful in your tests, especially when you get up into rank 2 and rank 3. Well, what these enhancement cards allow you to do is they allow you to trade in before your roll to trade in certain positive dice for additional effects if you are successful. So you trade in a fortune die and you get this bonus, or if you trade in an expertise die, you get this bonus, or if you trade in a characteristic die, you get this bonus.
And to clarify, did you say you have to trade those in before you make your roll?
That's my understanding, because then it's too easy.
Right, you're putting up that chance of, I think I'm going to rock this roll, so I'm going to maybe drop a couple of my dice and gain these added benefits. Or maybe, you know, maybe it's a questionable role anyway, but you're kind of going for broke and want to really go balls out.
Yeah.
I love the mechanics. I think it's really interesting. I can't wait to dive in and actually see how players react to that.
And there's some pictures of a couple sample cards on the article they posted on the forum.
To be honest, I'm a little trepidous about this. I think that there's a potential that they're getting too cute. That they are modifying the mechanics of the system, relatively significantly, kind of in midstream.
But I think one of the things that they've managed to do with this game, to its credit, I agree with you that it's getting a little funky, but at the same time, all the components that they've added with each of these modules, on some level, for the most part, the game can live with it or without it. You know, you can completely play this game as you have without these enhancement cards, and you're no worse off. You know, you could almost do the same with corruption. You can almost do the same without mutations. I mean, these are all great things to add to the game. Now, the enhancements, I think, are probably the least exciting of the bunch, I think. But the each one is more of almost like an optional advanced rule you could add or do without.
I disagree with you there because corruption and mutation are player detriments, whereas the enhancements are player advancements. They're player benefits. So if your players know that enhancements are available and you've got the deck of cards with you, when would they ever not want you to use that?
Oh, well, sure, but I'm saying, like, you know, if I did not own Omens of War and never got that deck of cards to play my game, my players would still have just as much fun as they had before that, and I could, you know, we'd still be having a great time.
Yeah,
it's not a required component in order to continue to enjoy the game. It really just adds a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely been developed in a modular fashion, which I do like. Like, you can have a great time just playing right out of the core set.
I mean, we've been doing fine and enjoying the game and liked it enough to start a podcast on it before these enhancements cards came around. So it's not like they're that exciting.
And I think the fact that you have to, as a character, spend, it seems to me you have to spend an advancement point in order to get an enhancement card.
I would assume that they would kind of take up an action card advancement slot, like I would assume.
So that seems to me like that will kind of put some checks and balances on characters using those. I mean, as it stands right now, really the way I run it in games is if they want to enhance their action, I just give them a stress or fatigue penalty or add difficulty or misfortune to the check.
Yeah, and I guess that's something, you know, I'm just, as I'm getting into the podcast session that we just started recording and also my own, you know, home session stuff that I did, I still haven't explored the entirety of the mechanical space of Warhammer 3rd Edition yet. I mean, I haven't had a spellcasting PC yet, whether it's a divine or a colleges of magic, you know, stuff like that.
So we had a spellcaster, but I've never played with a faithcaster.
Yeah,
I've never had a faithcaster though, so I don't.
So it's just in my mind, you know. Again, I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater or anything like that, but I'm just concerned that with every expansion that they come out with, you know, are they going to keep adding on more and more mechanics to it and potentially really start confusing things as opposed to expanding what they already have? I love that, you know, when you get Witch's Song, you get a couple more insanities or you get a couple more critical wounds.
Yeah, new career or
talent.
I don't want to see talent cards,
but I mean, corruption, absolutely.
Disease.
Mutation, diseases, you know, those are the tenets of the Warhammer world. But now that they're going to go down this kind of, this other kind of road and start throwing in these mechanics, it's definitely a wait and see approach from my standpoint.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not necessarily jumping up and down saying, ooh, this is the coolest thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the optional new rules now where you're getting the options for mounted combat is super cool. I mean, I like the idea that they're adding these new modules, but I totally agree where if they're using new modules to flesh out the Warhammer world, that's one thing. If they're using these modules to just keep adding optional rules elements on top of each other over and over and over again, especially if some of these future optional rule components build upon previous optional rule components, and that's really going to start becoming a pain in the butt.
I have a feeling they're not going to really go too much in depth
after they do.
Like, Slaanesh, I think, will be the last one that adds some sort of new mechanic to the game necessarily.
You think?
Because I mean, well, did Witch's Song, apart from bringing hedge magic in, which is useful for the careers that they
brought in? But that's just action cards. Action cards are already a mechanic of the game, so that's... Well,
exactly.
There'll be loads of more action cards. You know that's gonna happen.
Yeah, so have, besides the expansions like Signs of Faith, Winds of Magic, and now Omens of War, have any of the other modules that they've released come with any new mechanics?
No.
Mechanics, so then, no. But I mean, like, you know, we did get Greenskin Magic, we got some Beastmen and Chaos Magic. But again, those were all action cards. Mm-hmm. Actual game mechanic changes, you know, they introduced Corruption, they introduced, it really fleshed out miscast diseases, and then we have these enhancement cards.
And the severity, the severe wounds, right?
Oh, and the severe wounds, which are coming. You're right. There's actually three new rule additions.
And then I have a feeling Slaanesh will maybe do something, although
it's just another chaos power. We're going to see mutations, we'll see chaos magic, and we'll see an adventure, and we'll see creatures.
No, but if they're doing the same thing where they're aligning. You know, so Winds of Magic was the magic class, magic ideas, plus Tzeentch.
Yeah, Corruption and Mutation.
Signs of Faith was disease, mm-hmm. you know, Nurgle and disease, plus the faith side. This one's gonna be the military classes, so the Slaanesh is gonna be rogues, nobles, you know, shadowy people.
The halflings?
Halflings was going to be my guess, but I don't think rogues is the right matchup for Slaanesh, even though
it's a
from a timing perspective, it's appropriate to fill out that component, but it doesn't seem like the proper counterpart mix to it. Halflings, because of their indulgent side, would be very appropriate.
I still think they're gonna flesh out. So, you know, you've got your spellcasters taken care of, you got your combat guys taken care of. Now, maybe the non-combats, you know, put it all together. The investigative, the political, the rogues, the thieves, you know, put all of those together.
Something separate. I think those are gonna come paired with, like Skaven or something else like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Could be though.
Anyway, I think that's an appropriate amount of speculation.
Don't anyway me, Paul. Damn it.
Trying to keep things moving here, guys. We don't want this to be a 3-hour podcast.
Yes.
So I think the last thing that we wanted to talk about in the news was, just how our gameplay sessions are going. So as I mentioned, we did record. Thanks again, everybody, for offering to join our gameplay sessions. I think we're going to be looking at doing some more open type ones, maybe even not recording them, but just talking in general about online game playing and map tool stuff.
Yeah, Jesse, I know there is a bit you know, obviously you guys have seen that a lot of the sessions we do for our recorded gameplay sessions, we use map tools and Skype, and essentially none of us live together. We all live in various parts of the U.S. or even in different countries for that matter. So we're really big into being able to play these games remotely. And I know that's a little bit of a weird concept for a lot of people. So we are, we do have in the works, planning a session where we are going to invite everybody who has expressed an interest in playing with us, to do kind of one large, hey, this is map tools, this is how it works, this is what it can do, what it can't do, and really just kind of get that community together and start some conversations on playing. And then from there, we can kind of take it and see who wants to maybe run some games, who wants to participate in some games. We're training up some new GMs on our side too to be able to run maybe multiple sessions at once. So, in the near future, we're going to be able to, get the community a little more involved with map tools as a gaming platform. And additionally, Lester and I have been toying around with the idea of recording some, kind of webinar, a pre-recorded webinar or on-screen recording, recordings or tutorials on how to use map tools, how to set up the rule set that I've developed for it, and how to use it to either design games or to use some of the modules that I've created for it. So you guys can watch those at any time. I haven't actually begun developing them yet, but it's something I'm looking at in the near future.
Yeah, they're really nice. The modules that Jesse's created are fantastic, and the tools you have at your disposal with MapTool it's phenomenal. But I I was just going to say that I do like the way that Paul took it, like, 'cause we get two separate experiences, when you were GMing than
right.
From
so what Lester is referring to there, the game sessions that I was running for Eye for an Eye and the one before that were using the modules that I'd created with the fully, you know, maps, NPCs, full graphic layout while we're playing. And what we discovered while doing that is that those sessions are probably best for the people who are actually playing in them because they get the full visual experience. But from a recorded podcast perspective, unintentionally, it leaves a little bit to be desired with the actual physical descriptions of the environments and what players are doing, because the people who are playing have all these visual aids while the people listening to the audio don't. So what we've done in our most recent recorded session that Paul is GMing, where we started the Eye for an Eye campaign, the Gathering Storm campaign, is we've actually removed the visual elements from it and are really only using the tokens and location cards and almost playing the game as it's intended, just on a virtual tabletop without all the visual aids. And
yeah,
Paul, there's a lot of benefits that have kind of come out of that from a perceived podcast listening perspective.
Well, I'm pretty much I'm a pretty orthodox RPG player. I mean, I think I've mentioned before, you know, I'm a pretty rules as written type guy. So, I really wanted to keep the house rules down to a minimum and really see about replicating the core Warhammer 3rd edition process online, cuz it's not built around not that there isn't a way that you can do that, and it's not necessarily a right way or a wrong way, but you don't need to have the battle map. You don't need to have the, I can only move six spaces, and what happens when I move diagonally on the grid and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's very abstract. It doesn't require a lot of, miniatures or terrain or things like that. And that's really just what I tried to replicate with that.
I think the listeners are going to be in for a treat. I think the first recorded session we did over this last weekend for Paul's game, which will probably be up available for download in about a week or so, is really, I thought, went great, and Paul did a great job GMing it. So you guys will be in for a treat when that hits. And we did invite two other community members to join us for that session, in addition to Lester and myself.
Yeah, but we're definitely going to wrap up Eye for an Eye. We owe you guys the last episode.
I'm hoping to do that this weekend and maybe have it up for next Tuesday, but I need to coordinate with that gaming group and make sure they're available. The last weekend we would have recorded, unfortunately, didn't work for my schedule.
And just to make clear for everybody, we didn't put up any content last week, and that's okay. That's going to happen every now and again. Really, you know, what we are guaranteeing to you, the listeners, is that every other week you're going to get at least an hour's worth of podcast where we're going to do the questions and the news and the system spotlight and the main topics. We may have some special type podcasts later on, but every other week, plain as clockwork, you know, you will get Reckless Dice podcast episode N+1.
Now, last 2 weeks, 2 weeks ago, they did get Eye for an Eye episode 2 and 3 back to back.
So
we doubled up 1 week and skipped the other.
Exactly. Those in between weeks, those are variable. They're going to change. We're going to shoot for maybe one play session, or maybe there's going to be a feature. Maybe even we'll do some of the recordings or things like that Lester was talking about. But that's really going to be kind of a catch-all. So if we're not there, don't worry about it. We're definitely going to be back next week with a regular episode. So please do keep listening. Anything else for the news, gentlemen? Anything that we missed?
No, man. Let's talk some magic.
All right, so we're going to take a break, and on the other side, we'll come back with our system spotlight, which is magic. And we're back. So here for the system spotlight on episode 6, we're going to talk about magic. We're going to talk about the mechanics of spellcasters. Now, pretty basic trope in your fantasy roleplay games, we've got two types of spellcasters. We have the magic, the wizard types, and then we have the priests or divine types. But there's some pretty interesting things that are specific to Warhammer and specific to 3rd edition that I think puts a different spin on what we're looking at. the first thing to understand with the mechanics of spellcasting on both sides is that it's a point-based system. So there is a certain amount of mana that you have to take a computer role-playing game trope. And that amount of mana that you have is what you use to power the spell. So it isn't like old school Dungeons and Dragons or even the new school stuff where, you memorize spells and then you only can cast one spell, or you've got, you know, 5 level 1 spells and 3 level 2 spells, and that's all that you can do for the day. So it is managing power and using power points. They're actually called power on the wizard side, and then favor points on the divine side.
So from a wizard's perspective in the Warhammer world, you know, there's the winds of magic that flow around the world, and these wizards have essentially attuned themselves to be able to tap into those streams of power and funnel it through them. And what they're doing is you have a certain amount of power that flows through you just at a natural state, and what they call that is the wizard's equilibrium. And he, from there, is able to pull more power from the winds of magic and build that power up with inside him, almost like kind of supercharge himself like a battery, and then unleash that power through casting spells. But, you know, there are some game mechanics that actually force the wizard over time or each turn, for example, for that power that he's generated to attempt to pull itself back to that wizard's equilibrium. And a more powerful wizard will have a higher equilibrium available to them.
Yeah, so base rule is equilibrium for both arcane and divine casters is going to be your willpower. So if you have a willpower of 3, you naturally have 3 power points or 3 favor points that you've got grabbed. From the beginning, we'll talk about the wizard side, the arcane side first. What that action is that Jesse was talking about is actually a specific action called channel power. And if you start with a caster class or a caster career, you automatically get that action. It's a specific action that you get. And channel power, what you do is you do a channeling test against your willpower, and then based on that, you gain power points. And the power points, when they go above your or below your equilibrium, it's always going to go back towards that center. So say I've got an arcane wizard. I use the channel power action. I get 2 successes on the conservative side. So, cause like all other actions, there's a conservative and a reckless side. So I'm in a conservative stance. I use the channel power as my action. I get 2 successes on it. That's going to gain 3 power. So I go from 3 power to 6 power. Now what happens is, now that I'm over my equilibrium, at the end of the turn, the end of turn phase, the same time where you take off one recharge token from everything, you're going to lose one power as it brings you back towards equilibrium.
Or for that matter, you'll gain a power if you're below your equilibrium. It'll move 1 point towards your equilibrium wherever you are at the end of the turn.
At the end of the turn. But if you're above and you're losing the power, you can hold on to it by spending a maneuver. So basically, if you've already used the maneuver in your turn, then you can burn a fatigue to spend an extra maneuver to get
it. Now, would it be fatigue or stress, since it's magic?
I believe maneuvers are always fatigue.
Even though it's a mental action, in theory?
I'm pretty sure that's the case. Yeah, I'm pretty sure, well, and if we got it wrong, we'll definitely put it in the show notes, but if you convert fatigue into maneuvers into keeping your power or keeping your favor, as the case may be.
Now, there's also something really cool, because what's happening when you're doing this channeling power is your wizard is drawing the power from the winds of magic and bringing it into himself in order to cast a spell. Now, the thing is that channeling power, it's a little bit fickle, just like magic, which is kind of the essence of chaos anyway, is you don't always know how much you're going to be pulling in at once. You might pull in way more than you anticipated, you might just pull in a little, and there is a chance when you're channeling power, especially if you're already over your equilibrium, is you might actually consume or pull in too much power, which is something where you're actually going over your power threshold, where essentially you basically, your battery is about to explode.
Right, and that's double your willpower. So again, with our example, you've got a willpower of 3. If your power at the end of the turn goes over 6, if you've got 7 or more power, then you run in danger of that burnout. And basically what you do is you do a test. And if you're unsuccessful at that test, then you're gonna vent power.
I think what your options are is you can spend a maneuver in order to kind of maintain it for that turn.
Yep.
And then if you do not spend that maneuver, or voluntarily or involuntarily, because that maneuver, that point of fatigue might actually knock you into unconsciousness or something, your body will vent all of that excess energy that you've accumulated out in a violent magical explosion, bringing you back to your equilibrium, but will also cause your character a tremendous amount of stress and fatigue. And because you're already knocked out at that point, odds are you're also going to be taking some insanities. So overpowering your character and uncontrollably venting that energy that you've taken on can be almost catastrophic to a wizard, but certainly it'll take temporary insanities, but some of those could become permanent.
Yeah, it's my understanding that if you're ever above your power threshold, or your favorite threshold, you have to spend a maneuver and a stress in order to hold in any power that is above your, your
double
threshold.
Your willpower.
Yeah, if it's over double your willpower, then you automatically suffer a stress and you have to spend a maneuver. If you don't, then, like you said, Jesse, it vents, and it can be devastating. Like, it can literally kill a character.
So when you vent, you're going to suffer 1 fatigue for each point of power that you vented. So, for example, if we're at 7 points and we vent, we're going to get 4 fatigue right off the bat.
And for most characters, that's enough to put you down if you've already been in battle.
And then you roll a misfortune die for each power that you vented. For every challenge symbol generated, you get 1 wound, and for every bane generated, you gain a stress.
Yeah. So odds are you're taking, four fatigue, 3 stress, and probably 2 or 3 wounds. And for a wizard character, that's gonna severely cripple you.
Yeah, you can put yourself into the strained condition very easily if you're not careful with managing your power and.
But that's assuming you were completely unwounded when this happened.
Yep.
Yeah, so it definitely is. There's a big risk and reward kind of thing there.
Who's the Bright Wizard playing in our Eye for an Eye campaign was doing just a tremendous amount of damage when he was able to accumulate enough power, because a lot of his spells allowed him to, that he might have a spell that cost 4 power to cast, but he could spend an additional point of power to add an additional point of damage. So if he had 10 power in his pool, he could spend 4 casting the spell and then drop the other 6 into it to add 6 more damage to it and just obliterate something.
And needless to say, he charred a couple of the enemies.
Oh yeah, man, near the end of that third session, he was just lighting people left and right. He was out of control.
Yeah. So, and to help manage that kind of stuff, that's where some of the special. Magic items come into play. So you've got like attuned items that can help out with your channeling, and there's some other items that you have as well that modifies your equilibrium. So moving your equilibrium from 3 to 4 is a big deal. I mean, that's so you can gain so much more power and hold on to it without running into that trouble. So if you're kind of savvy and you remember that you get basically 1 action per turn. So if you pull all that power into yourself, you go over double your willpower, double your equilibrium, and you run that danger, you've got to go through that end of turn before the next turn comes around and you can actually cast your spell. Or you can do what's called quick casting, which is one of the only times in the game that you're allowed to do basically 2 actions during a single turn. So you're allowed to channel power and cast a spell on the same turn, kind of counting it as the same action. But the penalty that you take for that is you get an extra challenge die to your spell casting roll to actually cast the spell. So chances are that spell isn't necessarily going to go off.
And you have a higher chance of rolling chaos stars, which cause miscasts, which can be devastating to not just you, the caster, but everybody who's close to you.
Now, it's also important to note that a miscast does not necessarily mean that your spell has failed. It just means your spell went off along with a whole bunch of potentially bad effects.
Yeah, the only way it fails is if you don't generate any successes and generate a chaos star.
Correct.
And I think that's touching on the classic fantasy battles game where if you miscast, the spell still goes off, but you also suffer a bunch of penalties, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, some of them, I mean, even with the new 8th edition rules, the miscasts have been made extremely volatile. They're quite deadly to wizards. Now, wizards are meant to be extremely powerful and extremely fickle.
Oh yeah, like you and half of your army can get sucked into the warp and just be gone. So I don't know if it's that intense in the role playing game. I haven't really.
It's not. It's a little safer. But you know, I think we will in the future start seeing. You know how we're seeing these critical wounds and we're kind of expecting these new severe critical wounds to maybe just be folded into the wound deck as kind of like the equivalent of when you roll that 99 or 100 on a D100 so you kind of generate that critical.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if they're going to start doing stuff like that for, you know, kind of hardcore miscasts or hardcore mutations and things that maybe cause a little extra damage in the future.
Well, and there has been some interaction with that, right? So some of the miscast cards that have come out since the corruption rules came out in Winds of Magic actually has, you know, do a corruption test, do a hard corruption test or things like that. So the idea that miscasts lead to corruption and lead to mutation, which are kind of a permanent effect along with the severe injuries, you know, is kind of already built into that. Yeah. One of the things mechanically I want to talk about miscasts is that there's an interesting written into the rules, and I'm specifically looking at the player's guide. There's a specific kind of order of battle for miscasts. If you get chaos stars on any of your spell casting rolls, you first spend those chaos stars on the spell itself. So if the spell itself has a chaos star line in terms of the result lines, you spend it on that first. And then if any are left over, then you draw from the miscast deck. So actually having a negative effect, having that chaos star on a spell, actually makes the spell a little safer than,
interesting.
Than,
I did not,
than the other
yeah,
spells.
It's like a, yeah, it's like a buffer between the miscast deck and, you know.
Not all miscasts are all that bad. Some of them are pretty tame. So, you know, maybe even the effect on the card sometimes is actually worse.
And
well,
some of them can be
I'm
beneficial.
I'm looking at some of my cards here. So, like, I'm looking at Steel Life of the Amethyst Order. It's one Chaos Star is gain one Corruption.
I'm looking at
the Beast Made Well on the Amber Order. You suffer two wounds. You know, so there's definitely a handful of them there, but they're not. Here's Tide of Years, the rank 3 Amethyst Order spell. Two Chaos Stars, you are affected by this spell as well as the target. So it's not going to be a good thing that happens to you, but it is going to be something that's very specific to the spell that you're casting.
And some of the miscasts affect everybody in an encounter or within close range of you, so that also can include enemies. So there are slight benefits built into it, but you definitely don't want to be miscasting. That's not what you want to be shooting for.
You know, so the other form of magic, though, that actually kind of goes is the polar opposite of the arcane is the divine magic, which mm-hmm. has a very similar but different mechanic behind it.
It's almost much safer.
It's safer, but it is a little I'm not sure slower to react is the right word, but instead of having power that you spend to cast your spells, divine magic works more like you're praying. And once you've prayed sufficiently, you incur that blessing. So what will happen is you choose a blessing that you want to cast, and then you begin generating favor until you reach that threshold. So it operates a little bit different from the magic perspective.
Yeah, the way I see it is it basically the caster from a divine perspective invokes a blessing, so they go through, you know, Hail Mary full of grace or whatever.
Exactly.
And they try to invoke the blessing. So they try to get, you know, whatever. A minor ward would be giving
Mark of Chaos video intro for that video game has a Priest of Sigmar at the end of the video. He fights a Bloodthirster, and it's a perfect example of kind of how this might happen in game mechanics, is where he grabs hold of the Hammer of Sigmar necklace around his neck, and he starts chanting to it, and as he begins chanting, it starts glowing, his hammer starts to glow, and he starts kind of incurring the favor of Sigmar before going into battle. So it's not like all of a sudden, bam, there's a fireball. You know, he actually builds up that power as he kind of prays to the god.
Yeah, that's actually a really good example for it, for sure.
But that is a very unique mechanic. Usually it's, you know, you gather the power, then you cast the spell.
Right.
This is the opposite. You cast the spell, and then you gather the power. So there's some interesting
timing. Well, you don't actually cast it. You don't get the benefits of it until you reach the...
But you take the test. You roll the test, so the spell either succeeds or fails.
And if it fails, you automatically lose one favor, but on your next turn, you can attempt to invoke the blessing once again.
Now, it does say let's say you're going to be casting a blessing that requires, let's say, 6 favor to cast. There is actually a penalty if you, because that may take you several turns of power generation to divine magic favor to generate. So what'll happen is if you choose to abort that spell or prayer mid prayer, you actually suffer some pretty substantial penalties. Mm-hmm. Let's see, I think it's you even suffer a stress and maybe even some fatigue if the what was it here? Let's see.
So the amount of favor lost is equal to or less than the character's willpower. You suffer one stress.
If it's greater, you suffer a stress and a fatigue.
Stress and a fatigue, yep.
So there is penalties for kind of like saying, I'm going to cast this situation. Because being a priest requires essentially planning one turn ahead of what you want to cast.
Well, no, just like the wizard, you can do what's called in dire need, and you can curry favor on the turn that you invoke a blessing. And
yeah, for those little short ones. But there are, you know, all the good stuff, like any wizard or any priest, all the big spells are going to take more than one turn to prepare. Yeah.
But the blessings tend to have lower favor costs than the spells, because they're a lot less spectacular.
Some do.
Yeah.
And the important thing as a GM that you have to realize is two things. Is one, a priest can only have one blessing, and that's the terminology that the Warhammer game uses, right? Spells and blessings. Mm. You can only have one blessing active at a time. And all favor that you are gathering goes towards that blessing. So you can't like have one in the chamber and one on deck. You know, you can't chain your blessings.
So like a wizard could cast armor on themselves and then start throwing fireballs while a priest is stuck to the one blessing.
Mm-hmm. No, because you have to gather the power and then you cast the spell and then next turn you cast another spell.
But you could in theory generate like 10 power, spend 4 of it one turn casting some armor on yourself, and then the next turn, you know, do a channel power and a quick cast and throw another fireball out there while you've got 6 turns of armor still stored up on your character as a wizard.
Yeah, but that same thing can happen with the priest as well.
I thought you were explaining that the priest can only have one active spell at a time, or one active blessing at a time.
Right, but when that blessing fires, right, when that blessing takes effect.
Yeah, once it's gathered enough favor.
You can take, right, gotcha. You can take your leftover favor. And again, if you have, for some reason, right, you cast a blessing that only has 2 favor and your equilibrium is 3, the blessing goes off immediately.
Yeah, exactly.
As soon as that blessing gains enough favor, it fires as long as it's on your turn. Mm-hmm. Only the defensive type blessings can go some other time, right? If there's some sort of weird mechanical rule that allows you to gain favor away from your turn, and that finally gives you that one last point to fire off a blessing, the blessing does not take effect, unless it specifically says defensive or not on your turn, until your turn comes around.
Okay.
Cool.
But again, you know, there isn't any reason why you can't, you know, so you're below your favor, right? You're, for some reason, you invoke next turn, you know, you gain that one extra favor, that blessing goes off, and then you use your actual action to do a quick cast, to do it in dire need and cast a second blessing. That can potentially work. So just like with the arcane spellcaster, you can fire them off one after another. You just can't be currying favor on one blessing and another blessing at the same time. So you can only invoke one blessing at a time.
Yeah, to use your parlance, you can only have one on deck. Because you can essentially invoke a blessing if you have zero power. Or zero favor, sorry. You just have to wait for the favor to accumulate. And as you curry favor, it automatically goes to any currently invoked blessing.
Which is the only one that you have.
Exactly.
You have multiple invoked blessings.
So there's one last part that we hadn't really touched on. Kind of the opposite of having excess power is being forced to lose more power than you're capable of dishing out. You know, you're not allowed to go below zero. If you're forced to go below zero for some reason, you actually do suffer some additional stress and are forced to make some a discipline check or suffer some additional penalties. So really what you want to do as an arcane character or a divine character is stay within or around your equilibrium as best as possible and, you know, manage your power and favor effectively.
Yeah. So if you go below zero, then you basically take a discipline check with the difficulty of how many below zero you are, right? So if you're at -1, it's an easy difficulty check. -3, it's a hard discipline, difficulty check.
And the thing is if you succeed, you suffer a stress. If you fail, you suffer a stress and a temporary insanity with the chaos or I think a trauma trait.
And
trauma if it's divine. The other one would be arcane.
Yeah, I think the last thing that we missed is that if you fail an arcane spell, not a blessing, if you fail a blessing, you lose one favor. If you fail a spell, you lose all the power.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So whether or not it works.
It's spent either way.
So the two, just really quickly, before we move on, the two priestly skills that are required to cast spells are the advanced skills are to invoke and have blessings go off are invocation and piety, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what are those for the arcane classes?
Channeling and
spellcasting.
Okay.
And those are only available to divine and arcane characters.
And the important thing to remember around that is spellcraft, not spellcasting.
Oh, sorry.
A character that starts with an arcane career automatically gets channeling and spellcraft. A character that automatically starts in a priestly career does not. You have to spend for it.
Oh, do you automatically get it trained or you automatically get access to it?
You automatically get it trained, I believe.
Oh, really? That's crazy. I didn't realize that.
But because not all priests can do blessings, you can be kind of a lay priest. There is the priest career does not automatically. You do not automatically acquire invocation or piety.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. So you have to pay. So in that case, you would have to pay one advancement to gain access to invocation. One. To gain access to piety and then an additional one to train each of those?
Correct.
So it would be four skills in total to train those two, or four advances in total to train those two skills?
Yeah, you would have to invest creation points to acquire those skills. But if you do acquire those skills, then you do get the basic action cards for free. So if you begin the game with piety acquired, you gain curry favor for free. If you begin the game with invocation acquired, you gain blessings of health, minor blessing, and minor ward cards for free.
Okay, see, I went about doing that wrong when creating the priestly character for my home-based game. That's all right, now that's clarified. One last thing that I really, really like about the mechanics of this magic system are how they built in cantrips or minor spellcasting, and how it's pretty much open to player and GM interpretation. Like the cantrip spell can cover, it runs the gamut of all cantrips, I guess, in other role-playing games. You just have to describe what you want to do, and it is essentially a minor effect.
Yeah, but it's something the equivalent of a Bright Wizard lighting a candle, because, you know, it's pretty safe to say a Bright Wizard's capable of lighting a candle if he can light a fireball. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's something to, the little stuff that you just, well, they're not necessarily guaranteed success. They're pretty darn easy to accomplish as a basic wizard.
Well, and they specifically give you some guidelines around that. So to take that Bright Wizard example, lighting a candle is trivial. You can just do it. Lighting every candle in the room is an easy check. Lighting and maintaining a fire during a blizzard so you don't freeze to death would be an average check. So there's actually some fairly significant game implementations that you can do with a cantrip. It's kind of the magical version of the perform a stunt.
Yeah. It's cast that spell that there isn't a specific action card for.
That's fantastic. I love it.
But there isn't really one for the blessing side of things.
Just minor blessing and minor ward, but those are, like you say, they're much more specific.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some gods.
Cool. All right. So we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back around, we're going to dig into the gods of the old world and faith in the old world. And we're back. So we've got a main topic here. We're going to talk about faith in the old world. We're going to dig into specifically the gods of the empire, because Warhammer 3rd Edition is very much focused on that. They do touch a little bit on some of the dwarven gods and some of the elven gods. And, of course, we have been talking about the ruinous powers, the chaos gods as they are. But really, today we want to kind of focus in on not just the god of the empire, which is Sigmar, but the rest of the pantheon as well. So, Lester, why don't you give us a rundown of what we're looking at here?
Okay, well, I think the first thing to really bring to the forefront is the fact that polytheism is the name of the game here. Everybody worships a god, or worships the gods, I should say, in the empire, and in fact, it's very bad form not to, and chances are the witch hunters will hunt you down and kill you for being corrupt if you overtly don't worship these gods. There are 10 in total, but two of them kind of roll in together. And there's a long and storied history behind all these gods, but we're going to just do a really...
It's very Olympian, isn't it? It's like, oh, yeah. You know, fathers and sons and mm-hmm. things like
that. Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's... I don't know. It goes into a lot of, they go into a lot of detail in different books, which at the end of this, I'll give you guys some reference points of where you can find more in-depth information about this. But really, we're just going to do a quick breakdown of the main gods worshipped in the empire. The first and the most, I guess the most prolific and the most highly worshipped within the empire is Sigmar, who he's kind of more so like a hero in the Olympian sense. He was the man, he was a mortal originally, who kind of got all these different tribes together that live in what is now the empire, and he collectivized them and turned them into an empire.
He's what kind of took them from a series of barbarians into a civilized nation.
Yeah, precisely. And kind of, he did a bunch of things, and anybody familiar with the Warhammer mythos will know about Sigmar.
So then, and his famous icon is the Warhammer, the hammer itself, which is almost all imagery on Warhammer is based on Sigmarite imagery.
Exactly. It's called Galmaraz, the skull splitter. But, mm-hmm. that's the main focus.
A quick fun note for anybody playing Eye for an Eye campaign, the hammer that you acquire within Grunwald Lodge is a replica of Galmaraz.
Yeah, exactly. He so essentially he kind of disappears at the end of his days, at the end of his reign. He kind of just up and walks away, abdicating his throne and disappearing over the World's Edge Mountains. And a few years later, this guy named Johann Helsberg, I believe his name, or Hellstrom, he comes forward and starts preaching the word of Sigmar, stating that the gods that were previously worshipped had accepted him into their pantheon, and he essentially, through a lot of bickering and battle and civil war, became the main god that that imperial citizens worship. And that's kind of a point of contention between Sigmar and a couple of the other cults.
Now, the second symbol that's really important for Ulrich is the for Sigmar is the twin-tailed comet. It's the hammer and the twin-tailed comet.
Now, why is it the twin-tailed comet, Jesse?
You know, I'm sorry I don't know the specifics behind it, but those are the two major symbols, because the Sigmar being the dominant religion in the Empire, the hammer and the twin-tailed comet are the kind of the two major omens, that anybody will look for as a sign of Sigmar. So you'll see the twin-tailed comet everywhere.
Yeah.
In addition to the hammer.
Well, it's my understanding that that Sigmar's birth was actually, foreseen by the symbol. Like, he was born
heralded.
Under the sign. Yeah, heralded by the sign of this twin-tailed comet. The day he was born, it was in the sky. And it has appeared all over the mythos.
Now, I don't know if you guys want to get into Sigmar and some of the fun potential links between Sigmar and 40K. But this is kind of a fun one that's up for discussion. In that, okay, so the Sigmar was heralded by the twin-tailed comet, and he is this Olympian armored warrior that united the worlds, right? Okay. So, you know, what else leaves a twin-tailed comet that flies through the sky? You know, maybe a spaceship.
Well, yeah, but that's going to get really, if you want to get really esoteric in the religion of the old world or Warhammer in general, it is very space oriented because it taught,
sure.
Originally, it's all about the old ones who came right. through a Stargate and terraformed the world and did all this stuff.
Essentially, Sigmar was an ironclad warrior of just magnificent proportions. I mean, there's a lot leading to the fact that he might have even been a space marine.
Yeah, it is true. There are a whole bunch of differing ideas about how the two settings tie in together. He reminds me kind of like a Conan the Barbarian character. And he's definitely the main god in the Empire, much to the chagrin of the Ulrichans and the other countries.
Ulrich is kind of the other competing major religion mm-hmm. in the Empire, which is pretty much more dominant in the north, Marienburg, Kislev area. He's much more of a warrior god signified by the wolf and
Middenheim is
I'm sorry, Middenheim, yes, thank you. Marienburg is the one off near the wasteland. That's the independent city.
Yeah, it's actually been like I said, the main point of contention was Ulrich was the original god worshipped by the Teutogens and several of these other Unborogens, these other like ancient barbaric tribes that then unified to become the Empire. They were all worshippers. In fact, Sigmar, as a mortal, was a worshipper of Ulrich, who is a god of battle and like pack mentality.
Winter.
Yeah, winter and wolves, you know. He's kind of the god they pray to appease them from, to appease winter and things like that. And in fact, in the mechanics of the game, the priests of Ulrich have kind of frost powers.
They actually outnumber the Sigmarites in the north as far as, number of temples and who the dominant religion of most cities are.
Yeah, essentially.
Ulrich overpowers Sigmar pretty substantially in some areas of north.
Yeah, the only thing, like, the only real major temple that I know of that is in the lore in the south to Ulrich is actually in Altdorf. But in the north, like you say, his shrines and his temples are everywhere because he is essentially the main god. And it is stated that if Karl Franz were to ever pass away, Karl Franz being the emperor of the current emperor of the Empire.
In Altdorf.
He lives in Altdorf. If he were to ever pass away, that the Empire would fall into chaos and into civil war just strictly on the merit of Sigmar versus Ulrich.
If anybody really likes that whole concept of the battle between the two religions and dominance and civil war around that, there's a great second edition adventure, a series of campaigns that actually involve building up to a potential civil war and the players attempting to stop it between those two specific religions.
Okay, what's that one called?
I forget what it's called, but it's the big three-book campaign. I want to say Paths of the Damned, but I'm not sure if that's the right one.
That makes sense.
I think it's the third book that mostly alludes to the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a cool campaign.
So essentially now with Ulrich here, like we touched on, similar to Sigmar, he has several symbols, those being the wolf and other things.
Winter.
Winter, essentially. Those are kind of his domains and his symbols. And his worshippers tend to be quite battle ready and battle hardened and more so barbaric in nature as compared to the Sigmarites, who corruption has kind of overshadowed them. at this, I don't know, at this point in time, the Sigmarite religion is quite, corrupt, I guess. And then that we could get into Luther, Huss, and stuff like that, but I kind of want to keep this going really quick and do a quick layout for everybody. So one of the other more major gods is, his name is Mor, and he's the god of death, essentially. So he's not like an evil god by any stretch of the imagination. He's kind of the protector of spirits, and he is amorally opposed or diametrically opposed to
necromancy.
Yeah, necromancy.
The undead. If you're in a world where the dead can rise, then having a god that protects the dead and keeps them from rising, and the cult around that, built around, you know, anti-necromancy, protecting the dead, sanctifying the dead so that they can't be controlled to rise up out of their graves and take over the world, is a big deal.
Mor is also the god of dreams.
Yes. And his priests have access to that. They're kind of like soothsayers. They see the future, sort of. And they, their temples aren't actually temples at all. They're called Gardens of Mor, and they're essentially cemeteries. And the symbols of Mor are like the raven, the black rose, several other things along these lines. And his priests are actually,
I think the hourglass is another one.
Yeah, yeah. And his priests are feared throughout the old world, more so for what they stand for, even though you'd rather your soul go to the eternal Garden of Mor than be siphoned off into the realms of chaos and, you know, become the stuff of chaos. Yeah, that's like the ultimate torment that could happen to a mortal in the world of Warhammer. And so Mor plays quite a large role, even though it's a lot more specific than necessarily Sigmar kind of runs the gamut, being the main god, although he's focused on battle and the empire being his main point. And Mor is an older god. He's one of the original gods. Ulric was also one of the original gods of the humans. And then there's Manann. And Manann is, he's the god of life, but in a marine sense.
So yeah, he's the god of the seas.
Yeah, the god of the oceans and the seas and anything to
and
do
the rivers.
With that. Yeah, and the rivers and anything to do with that. He is the representation of that. So his symbols are like the trident and the five-pointed crown. He's similar to Poseidon, I guess, would be his real-world opposite. And he is a brother of Ulric, and he's also a brother of the god Tal.
Now, he's the son of Tal, I thought Tal was the All-Father.
Oh, okay. Well, I know Ulric is the brother of Tal, and Manann very well could be his son, because there is a lot of that, like you were saying earlier there, Paul, a lot of the – it's a family, essentially, these gods. And really the main thing to be said about Tal is he is the absolute original god according to the humans of the empire. Him and his feminine aspect, Rhea, they are the two original ones. The feminine aspect representing fertility and, you know, things along those lines, and then Tal being more the ferocious nature, the hunt and beasts and, you know, terrible weather and things along those.
Right. Rhea's kind of the domestic side of nature, the harvest, the fertility, those sorts of things. Tal is kind of the wild side of nature, the hunt, the hunters, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that we haven't really touched on yet, just kind of tying a little bit back to our last section, was that when you're playing a priest, similar to like when you're playing an arcane wizard, is you are specifically a priest of one of these gods, and a lot of your spells and actions and your kind of style will be dictated somewhat to the degree that the style that these gods portray or represent.
Yeah, as Lester mentioned at the beginning, in general, the populace is polytheistic. You may pray to one god above others, Sigmar or Ulric or something, or even Tal if you're out in the woods, but you still pay respects and pray to the other gods when their specific domains come
into
play.
I'm sorry, I was referring to that if you were playing a priest character, you'd be a priest of Mor or a priest of Sigmar. You would not be a priest who has access to all of these gods.
Right, so a commoner, you know, may pray to all gods, but Rhea is his primary god,
right,
versus an actual priest. When you dedicate yourself, you're dedicating yourself to that single god. You get that god's direct favor and ability to cast spells and things like that, but then you become, you know, singularly aligned towards that.
Right, that's so the most famous in Warhammer being the warrior priests of Sigmar.
Yeah. However, even a warrior priest of Sigmar would never set foot on a boat without flipping a coin into the river or saying a prayer to Manana.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just saying more from a game mechanic perspective. You only have access to the god that you have subscribed to.
It's because the gods are all jealous and fickle, very similar to the polytheistic religions on Earth, so you need to really focus and be pious towards one if you want to actually gain their, like, the incarnation of their power on this planet, I guess. Be a way of putting it.
See, Shalia is another big important one.
Shalia is one of the most important ones, and actually, now that we've kind of touched on those original, those first five gods that we talked about there, or I guess, well, one main thing to be said about Tal and Rhea is Rhea has kind of spread herself thin through her domains, and she covers a gamut of, like Paul was saying, domestic kind of things, but she runs through so many different domains that she's kind of spread herself so thin that the priests of Tal are really, they do all her kind of, her grunt work in the mortal realm, I guess it would be said. So if you were, mechanically speaking, to want to have access to Rhea's spells or blessings, you would be a priest of Tal.
Which is awesome because in the system, the priest of Tal is a balanced career. So you've got two spots towards the conservative, two spots towards the reckless. And all of the blessing cards, the reckless side is the Tal side, and the conservative side is the Rhea side.
Yeah, I thought that's a great
game mechanic representation of that. That's cool.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And I guess the way they kind of explain it in these different religious sources, is that because of the nature of the old world and how violent and dangerous it is, Tal has kind of gotten more of the worship. People worship him to kind of get appeasement and try to, you know, stave off beasts eating your livestock or whatever, more so than worshiping Rhea directly, although she still is worshipped directly. She just doesn't have any specific priests at this current timeline that the game takes place in.
I think one of the reasons we're really trying to cover all these different major gods of the Empire is a lot of these go overlooked for most games, where people just go straight to Sigmar and thank him for everything. You know, really, Sigmar's, you know, has a pretty specific role, and a lot of these other gods do too. And more often than not, there's a much more appropriate god to be influencing, you know, your players' actions or the NPC actions around them. And, you know, it really adds a lot of depth if you're able to pull the proper information at the proper time.
Yeah, totally. And it just, I don't know, it lends to a little bit more, like a deeper aspect of role play, I think.
Or really even just understanding the culture of the Empire.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much politicking between these different cults is what they're essentially called. These faiths, the organization of these faiths are referred to as cults within the lore. Mm-hmm.
Shalia was one that we were going to hit up on a second, which was probably one of the third most common ones outside of, or maybe even the second most common outside of Sigmar that our players would encounter, which is the goddess of healing and mercy.
Yeah, she's actually a foreign goddess. She comes from, like, the seat of power for Shalia is located in Caron in Bretonnia. And she originally comes from the region called Talay, which is essentially the Balkans and Rome, or Italy. And the people, the humans that live there.
Tilia.
Tilia, yeah. And they claim to be the progenitors, I guess, of organized faith and the written word and things like that, which is actually a huge point of contention between the Empire, because the Empire imperial citizens are all stubborn and they believe that, you know, they're the end all be all of the human race. And Shalia, like you said, is the goddess of mercy. Her symbols being like the blood drop or the heart.
Yeah, doves, the tears. Dove. And,
yeah. Cause she actually essentially is portrayed as, she's kind of a Christ-like figure in the sense that she goes through every single pain that any mortal could ever experience, any kind of misery or pain or discomfort she kind of experiences. And Moore, who is her father, she's actually the daughter of Moore and Verena, I believe. And she's kind of the temperament between those two. And we'll get into Verena a little bit further, but.
But the other thing about Shalya is that the places you generally encounter them in a game is when your players go and look for healing outside of a surgeon or a barber surgeon or something to that effect, is you might go to a temple of Shalya or a priestess of Shalya who might provide some kind of healing services to your characters or some kind of blessings for health. You know, they're the ones who are generally tending to the sick.
And that is one of the unique things about Warhammer is that, you know, you've got all of these priests out here, but the only ones who are going to give you healing is just one of those cults. It's not, you know, hey, you're automatically a cleric. You can automatically cast Cure Light Wounds.
Yeah, that is only one of these 10 can actually cure somebody.
Yeah, it's really cool. There's a whole bunch of, it's almost like a sub-career set within the priest career paths. You can actually really specialize your priest character. Like if you were an Ulrican or a Sigmarite, you were very powerful in battle and your blessings are geared towards the domains of your gods in particular. Like a priest of Moore he has a blessing that allows him to essentially see the future through dreams. And it's a pretty cool mechanic. But yeah, Shalya is the only one and she is diametrically opposed to Nurgle and she wants to relieve all suffering. One of the cool tenets I find with her is that because Moore is her father, he has dictated to her that she is never allowed to change his mind. If he wants a soul, if it's time for that soul to come, it's going to take it. He's going to take it, and she can't do it. So from Shalya, we can move on to Renald, who, in my opinion, is the most fun of all of the gods.
Yeah,
he's kind of like the trickster god, his symbols being crossed fingers, coins, the cross in general, like an X as opposed to the Christianized cross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like an etched cross on a doorway or something like that is typically a secret symbol to a shrine of Renald, whose shrines are not out in the open. Generally, they're hidden in places only those who are accepted followers.
Yeah, and his followers and his priests you can think of kind of as Robin Hood type characters. Steal from the rich, give to the needy kind of thing. They're tricksters. They play pranks all the time, and Renald revels in pranks.
And most thieves or any burglars or things like that, even though they may be a little faulty, would still be praying to Renald to help them.
And gamblers, anybody who wants luck on their side, will say, hey, Renald, please bless me kind of thing.
Well, and potentially the merchant class and things like that too.
Yeah. So. Yes, to appease him so that they don't get their stuff stolen and things along those lines, or to earn more coin. And he's a pretty fun one. I'm not actually that caught up on Renald to the point of knowing if he is a foreign god or if he is actually one of the native gods to the Empire, but he's the most fun in my opinion. And then we move on to Verena, who, like, she also comes from Talay. I believe Moore's seed is in Talay as well. But anyway, Verena is a goddess of knowledge and judgment, her symbol being the balancing scales and a sword. And the judges and the professors and people of that ilk are priests of Verena.
And that really embodies one of the kind of the Middle Ages Renaissance things of having the priesthood be the keepers of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because all initiates, that career class has access to the education skill, the advanced skill, to kind of show that they are cloistered and almost sheltered, but they're taught how to read these ancient texts.
And if I'm not mistaken, a temple of Verena is essentially the equivalent to a university or a library.
Well, they tend to be
built. That's where you would be finding the books.
Well, they tend to be built onto the libraries and the universities, and this has led to the idea that universities and libraries are actually temples of Verena, but that essentially isn't the case, because there are still basic lay persons who do educate the people. There's still lots of scholars and there's still lots of students and stuff.
But
like
I mean,
that.
If players in it from a role playing perspective were in a town and they wanted to do research on something or look up some old books or get some old information to try and find a way to solve some
seek
investigation,
out the
you might want to seek out the Temple of Verena because that's where most likely you would have access to a large library of
yeah.
tomes.
And it's actually against the strictures of Verena for any book to be destroyed, which puts them at a point of contention with the Holy Order of the Templars of Sigmar, who are the witch hunters, essentially, because the Verenians will hold on to chaos-riven books.
Blasphemous books.
Yeah, blasphemous books, because they believe that all knowledge is sacred.
Now, of course, they take precautions in order to try and keep them safe. They don't just, like, throw them on the shelf and say, have fun.
No, they lock them in vaults within their temples. So if you were to try to find esoteric or occult knowledge, you definitely want to seek out the Verenans. And that's the other – she's the other one that I really, really like. Rinald and Verena, they're my two favorites. And then we'll move on finally to Myrmidia, who's a really interesting goddess. And she comes also from Talay. And the – the story goes that there was a crusade many hundreds of years ago, and they went on essentially a crusade to a place called Arabia, I believe it is, or Araby. And
Araby,
okay. And they actually, the Myrmidians, kind of infiltrated these soldier castes that went on that crusade, and they came back as the Knightly Orders. I think it's the Order of the Blazing Sun was the original. That was the original Knightly Orders, which is something that will be addressed in the Omens of War. They'll talk more about these Knightly Orders. And all these Knightly Orders basically owe fealty to Myrmidia, who is the goddess of battle and tactics. Her symbols being the shield and the spear, her favored weapons. And these people, like you would, her temples would more so be like barracks or cadet schools where the priests trained through martial combat and learning tactics on the battlefield, like Sun Tzu tactics kind of thing. And that's her domain. And so there is, it's interesting. You can definitely see that war, you know, surprisingly so, war is very important in the world of Warhammer, because three of these gods, their specific domain falls under battle. The difference between Ulrich and Sigmar and Myrmidia is that Myrmidia is all about controlled use of tactics and skillful combat, whereas Sigmar and Ulrich are more so see
the
red
of battle. Yeah.
Exactly. See red, kill your opponent, sort of.
I'll quote the write up here in the GM's guide. The saying goes that Sigmar takes you to war, but Myrmidia brings you back.
Yeah.
I like that.
So that is really a basic rundown of the basic gods, the main gods of the Empire. One thing to note is that their effects are extremely tangible on the world. They do exist, and they affect the world in their own special ways. But really, they're similar to the Chaos Gods, and some of the students of the Arcane argue that they are just different iterations of the Chaos Gods, but that's a point of contention between scholars in the old world.
Going back to what you said about their effect, if you've noticed in a couple of the adventures that they have, they've kind of written that in there, and I really encourage GMs out there to write that into your things as well. So if somebody shows piety at a shrine, you know, they get a bonus to their next roll, or they get a beneficial condition, or things like that. So it's not just the priests that are out there, you know, blazing and casting the blessings and things like that, but it's actual, you know, that actual day-to-day impact of, you know, if you see a Temple of Shalia, I think in one of the adventures, if you go to a Temple of Shalia, if you haven't taken the life of a humanoid in the last month and you pray at the Temple of Shalia, then like your next rest period, you gain extra stress and fatigue or something like that. So there's a lot of little ways that you can make the gods, real in your games.
Yeah, I would
beyond
only
just priests casting spells.
Yeah, true. I would only argue not to overuse it, you know, to take mm-hmm. away from the weight of that. But yeah, I totally agree with you, Paul. And really quick to end off this Faith in the Old World segment, I just want to say a couple really, really, really good resources for knowledge about faith is obviously within the core set. There's the Tome of Blessings, which details three of the gods, Sigmar, Mor, and Shalia. And then if you get Signs of Faith, which is one of the modules, it details all the other gods and gives quite an in-depth discussion. It goes into quite a lot of depth about faith in the Old World. And then the last one would be a second edition book that was released in like 2007, I believe, and it's called Tome of Salvation, and it's full of all sorts of really, really
that
juicy
is a good one, you're
stuff.
Right. There's even some even supplemental books just for like kicks and the collectors that are dedicated specifically to like a handbook for Sigmar or a handbook on, you know, witch hunters, kind of like the Witch Hunter's Handbook or almost like a book that somebody might carry around with them as if they were, you know, almost like their prayer book to Sigmar. There's some fun ones for the collectors out there who might want to track those down sometime.
Yeah, The Life of Sigmar is one of those.
That's
but yeah, those
one.
Are
thank you.
Those are great resources for anybody interested in adding more of the faith aspect to
that's
the
kind of the you have to hit up eBay to find those most likely.
Oh yeah, that's a really hard
I
one.
I think they're out of print. There were some
DriveThruRPG may have them and RPG Now, those guys do a pretty good job of hanging on to the older editions.
So. Yeah, if anyone's familiar with the Imperial Guardsman's Uplifting Primer, which was a 40K version of that, it's kind of the fantasy equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So I think that wraps up our discussion about the faith in the Empire. So we're going to take our last break, and then we'll come back and wrap things up with your questions.
As always, you can submit your questions in written and audio format to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice. Simon Summerfield emailed us asking, how do you disengage properly? I would like to do it like this. Maneuver, disengage, and spend fatigue to run away, but NPCs take wounds instead, thus they can never flee without dying. Can you run past an engagement without getting caught up in it? So a couple part question there. Essentially, he wants to know, how do we disengage properly? And, you know, are you allowed to actually kind of skirt past the engages? I think he's more approaching it from a, more of a D&D perspective of when you move into an adjacent square, are you locked into
attack of opportunity?
Exactly. Yeah. So, we can touch on that one first, which is a little simpler. You are not, because of the, little high level approach to the ambiguity of where what's engaged with what, you are only engaged if you intend to be engaged in the Warhammer rule set.
Unless there's a from my perspective, unless there's a role playing reason. I mean, if there's a bar fight and it's taken up the entirety of the bar, then if you're in the bar, you're engaged, or you're engaged with somebody. You know, if it's a narrow hallway, if to get from A to B, you know, and the engagement is taking up the entirety of that area, then I would definitely say you'd have to be engaged to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree.
But again, that's a call based on, you know, almost a house rule, I guess, based on the locations. You never get forced into an engagement that you don't want to.
And Lester, you're familiar with the proper disengage rules. Can you run over those real quick?
As far as I understand Paul told me this, he's the resident rules guru. I would say, as far as I know, you pay just a maneuver to move out of an engagement. That's kind of representing that, you know, if you're in a combat engagement, you're kind of swinging your sword and, you know, giving yourself the opportunity to disengage as opposed to just stepping away and allowing someone to attack you.
Yeah, and to talk about that, NPCs, NPCs are, it's pretty much an official rule now with the guides. NPCs can spend ace dice, aggression, cunning, and expertise dice to have extra maneuvers. So instead of taking a wound to do that running away, they could spend, I believe, specifically aggression dice to not only just one maneuver to go from engaged to close, and then another maneuver to go from close to medium.
I really like that
example. Yeah.
I think that's great.
So our next question comes via Twitter from Mr. Llamatastic, He says he's ordered the starter box set for Warhammer 3rd Edition, and he already has the GM toolkit. And what he's done is he started a campaign with some of his pals using the 2nd Edition rules, and now that he's got the 3rd Edition bits in his hands, he's wondering how easy or flexible it would be for him to convert from 2nd Edition into 3rd Edition kind of mid-campaign, and if that's something that is kind of feasible, or is that going to be a little too tough?
I don't think there's really any problem with doing that. I mean, you've got your basics are all still there. I mean, it's pretty easy to take strength, toughness, willpower, fellowship, intelligence, you know, and kind of translate those across pretty close one for one. I mean, you know,
generally what I would do is kind of, it was all a D100 system before, so you just kind of divide everything by 10 and you're more or less have a pretty quick and dirty conversion mechanic built in.
Well, and if somebody has, like, say, a 37 in strength, right, maybe that's a 3 plus 1 fortune die.
Yeah, that's
a great way to hit that middle ground.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
And all the careers, you know, pretty much every career that was in 2nd edition more or less is going to be in 3rd edition as well. So you could very easily translate over to the new characters. You know, of course, you just translate the equivalent equipment over. You know, your players would have to be willing to kind of just take potentially a little hit here and a little bonus there. You're not going to have the exact same character with the exact same set of skills and everything. You might need to, you know, grab a couple new action cards and kind of take a little bit of a new approach to your character, but a conversion mid-campaign is not unrealistic.
No, and if you've got the Creatures Guide, you know, that can work well. I mean, there's all pretty much the base of the Warhammer creatures are represented in the Creatures Guide as well, so you can just take those, lift them straight out of there too.
Mm-hmm.
And our last question for today comes from Zwobot. And he asks from the Reckless Dice website, what about lore comparison between 3rd edition and Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd edition, Warhammer Fantasy Battles, and Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 1st and 2nd edition? Are there any considerable differences in lore across the different iterations, I guess you'd call, of Warhammer?
Well, I think there's some specifics about timeline, right? I mean, yeah. 2nd edition was specifically after the Storm of Chaos. 1st edition was before. 3rd edition is before. Fantasy Battle 8th edition rolled it back to before, even though 7th edition ran through the Storm of Chaos. But I think, from my perspective, the reality of it is that Warhammer has been, the Warhammer world has been in existence for over 30 years now.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it quite hit 30. But it's darn close.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been out there longer than pretty much any other RPG fantasy.
It's the longest running consistently published fantasy franchise in existence.
Yep.
So the idea, you know, there's so much information about there from so many sources. Take what you like and make the world your own.
Now, yeah, to that effect, sure. Though, there are actually some considerable differences between the different versions, and that kind of stuff really comes about between, you know, locations, different kinds of creatures that maybe existed in some editions that they've actually stripped from the lore or Games Workshop has refused to acknowledge as ever really being part of their history.
Like
the squats, for example, from 40K.
And
you know, there are certain things, yes, and Famirs are another good example.
Zotes.
Yeah, so there are things like locations of cities. You'll notice different iterations of maps throughout the different iterations of Warhammer may have slightly different geographical formations. Albion is a great example. Mm-hmm. In the current iteration of Albion, I think there's really one major island and one small island, where prior iterations of Albion had four similar-sized islands. So there have been changes to kind of accommodate the geographic and new style that the game has taken on. Because I think anybody can go back and look at Warhammer 1st edition and kind of look at that 80s punk kind of wacky, I'm not even sure what to call it, style that it had. And you can watch it actually evolve over the years into what it is now, which is a much more sophisticated, streamlined, very concise and controlled story and atmosphere. And over time, they've kind of pulled in those loose ends, they've refined them a bit, and given them a little more concrete appearance. So, There are differences. I think if you have to choose, though, kind of always go for the most current version. It tends to be the most sophisticated and more fully fleshed out than any of the previous stuff.
But don't be afraid to reach back and pull some things out.
No, there's loads of good stuff.
Yeah, you can really, especially if you have players that are experienced with the current version or the current sessions or stuff like that, go back and drag something out of first edition and drop it on them and surprise the hell out of them. I mean, that could be a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, certainly first edition adventures and second edition adventures are great ones just to upscale into third edition.
Yeah, and if you're looking for good access to lore, I mean, you can buy the old battle books, the fantasy battle books, for quite cheap now. Like, you can go buy the third edition and fourth edition books at used bookstores for like $5, and that gives you a general understanding of what the world's like.
Absolutely. So we appreciate all your guys' feedback and questions, and we do read all that come in and do our best to respond to them on the podcast as timely as possible. Please keep them coming, and we'll discuss them on future episodes.
Cool. So I think that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. Like I said before, we'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Please leave us comments on the site, recklessdice@rorschach.net. Send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at recklessdice. And please, please, if you do get us through iTunes, feel free to leave us a star review or some feedback on there. We'd love to hear from you. So for all of us, thanks a lot, and have a good night.
Hey, guys. Have a good night.
Thanks again, guys.
All right.